objecthood.
It can look like a gun, it can smell like a gun, but if you can't shoot somebody or defend yourself with it, then it's something else. Things are never,
things are never. Things are never.
In a passage from Michel Tournier's 1967 novel, Vendredi au les Lames du Pacifique, Friday, one of the two shipwrecked inhabitants of the desert island where the story takes place, throws a handful of gunpowder on a fire. Robinson, his friend and former master, jumps back expecting an explosion, but a beautiful, tall green flame flares up instead before vanishing in silence. Robinson's assumption is not particularly bizarre. After all, you cannot spell gunpowder without gun, which we instinctively associate with a blast. Friday then explains that a gun is the worst way of burning gunpowder. When it's shut up in the gunpowder gets angry, and when you let it out, it makes a big noise. If you leave it alone and free, it's quiet and beautiful. In 1945, an engineer named Percy Spencer, working at a military research facility, made an observation that led to a major accidental discovery. Spencer, who was conducting tests on vacuum tubes, suddenly realized that the chocolate bar in his pocket had completely melted. Others had noticed similar phenomena before, but it was Spencer who decided to further investigate the correlation. He didn't know it yet, but he was about to discover microwave cooking. Microwaves lie between infrared and radio waves in the electromagnetic spectrum. That is, they are too fast for us to perceive them as light, sound, or mechanical vibration. However, microwaves are absorbed by water and fat molecules, and when that happens, they generate heat. Enough heat to melt a candy bar in your pocket, if you're standing close enough to a powerful vacuum tube. Enough to heat up food very quickly if you put it in the right container, like a microwave oven, which traps the waves in a small chamber and makes sure they penetrate more or less evenly throughout whatever is on the oven tray inside. Just as the gun in Friday's parable turns an otherwise peaceful chemical reaction into a blast, the oven maximizes the potential of the waves by keeping them within the metal walls, making them angry, as Friday might say. Laboria Cubanics member Helen Hester, one of the guests in this fifth episode, suggests the microwave oven as an ideal example of an expanded and expansive take on objects and their social meanings. In the case of the microwave oven, the domestication of the military-industrial complex, which gave rise to a much larger network of interconnected things and processes to redefine food management in the home. Our devices are not just things. They are frozen embodiments of social relations, she says. And that also applies to objects all around us. From guns to microwavable popcorn, from desert islands to chewing gum on a sidewalk, from chocolate bars to images, which Hito Sterile, also featured in the program, uses as a springboard to talk about the dichotomy between objects and subjects. Sterile quotes Benjamin and rephrases Hester's frozen metaphor describing images as petrifications of desires and social energies, before wondering whether that social energy stored within objects can somehow explode and be released again. There you go. More explosions. Objects and their social implications take a radically different shape and form in the hands of Rula Parthenu, our third guest this time around. Her installations, consisting of large collections of what look like everyday objects, deal with perception, materialism, language, and the power of association. Sculpted foam and wood replicas of cigarettes, tape rolls, milk cartons, traffic cones, and a long list of commonplace things that she uses to trick the viewer in a game of double take and weird dissolving familiarity. Once again, this podcast is about objects. But more importantly, it is about recent ideas on objects in contemporary theory and art. So sit back, relax, and count down before diving into the first segment, featuring German artist, writer, and filmmaker Hito Steril. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
In this essay in Free Fall, I was trying to describe a shift in how people relate to the world visually. How do they orient themselves? And I tried to describe a sort of change of paradigm from a linear perspective towards a vertical perspective, which was at that point exemplified by, for example, the Google Maps paradigm, whereby when people are trying to walk in the streets, they are constantly seeing basically their own situation from above, which is very strange because, I mean, in fact, they are on the street, they are supposed to sort of navigate in a horizontal way, but the vertical perspective is sort of in between yourself and the end of the street, which is kind of very interesting. And I'm not 100% sure how this displaced the relation between subjects and objects. I mean, definitely there has been a lot of theory, especially film theory, feminist theories of the gaze and so on, which argued essentially that certain traditional ideas of the subject were constituted by a sort of mirror relationship with oneself in linear perspective. But of course, you know, this subject was always a kind of abstraction or fiction. It was the idea of a one-eyed observer that would essentially put himself into the center of the universe. And of course, this relation was established during a time when Western subjects tried to literally subject the world to their methods of navigation, of science, and of conquest, military technology, if you like. So in that sense, this idea of, you know, recognizing yourself as a subject was always accompanied in history with recognizing other people as objects, as slaves in particular. So in that sense, you know, the idea of subject, the traditional one, already contains this dialectic of humans as subjects and humans as objects. And I think definitely, you know, the idea of subject has continued to be fractured in this way, because most obviously the subjectivity of the laborer is partly an object subjectivity, you know, because the laborer sells parts of her time and, you know, turns them into commodities or entities to be traded. So in that sense, there was always a partial object character of human beings under capitalism on the labor market anyway. in that sense, we cannot separate, you know, the subject from the object, not only within, you know, material, inanimate objects. I'm not even talking about that. I'm just talking about human beings. And this has, you know, shifted in many ways with new technologies. I mean, if I just speculate now, but the amount of quantification every aspect of human activity is subjected to nowadays, basically every sort of motion, emotion, action being captured, counted, calculated, predicted, and so on. So in that sense, the objectification of, you know, all aspects of human beings has been intensified quite dramatically. And also the idea that not only labor power can be quantified, but basically other areas of human activities which were not necessarily seen as labor power, like looking, but also a lot of, you know, affective, emotional activities are now being quantified in the same way through new technologies. Money is a very good example of something in between matter and energy and even, you know, spiritual energy, whatever you like. And I think this is really my idea about objects as a whole, because objects, if you see them from the perspective of physics, are always already also energy, right? It's just a matter of looking at them from a different perspective. So basically, anything can transform into energy, and I would have to think about, but a lot of energy can be transformed into matter. And most of the things we see seem to be one or the other, but in essence, they could be anywhere on this spectrum, you know, between either being matter or energy. And money is a specifically good example because money has so many forms of appearance, right? I think probably in its purest form, money is just pure belief, religion, no? It's basically a spiritual activity of the human brain. It's just pure energy. But money can also be, it is, I think most money today is coded as light. Light which moves through fiberglass cables at the speed of light, of course, no? But money can, of course, also be materialized as real estate, as gold, as, you know, whatever you like. Money can also be activity, action, expenditure of energy. Money can be warfare. So in that sense, you have basically the whole spectrum from pure matter to pure energy, and money can basically morph between all of these. Probably it's a very classic Marxist idea, right? That and most objects or products are made by human energy and so and within social relations. And basically the object is like the condensation of social relations and human energy. And this has been expressed very clearly by Walter Benjamin, who describes images, for example, as literally petrifications of desires and social energies. And the idea is, if you have that object, can it somehow transform back into social energy? Can it basically explode and release the energy that's stored within them? So in that sense, it's a very, in a way, classical idea of an object, which is very different, I have to say, from many other, you know, object theories which are, you know, being discussed at the moment. There is nothing metaphysical about the objects I'm talking about. But they are physical, definitely, no? It's interesting, you know, because now I'm sort of following the development of neural networks, which are basically the attempt of creating some form of human-less subjectivity, or at least intelligence. So how does this work, you know? I mean, these are the liminal cases, which I find extremely interesting. How much human subjectivity goes into that, and there is a lot, no? But how is it then translated into something completely different, which cannot really be predicted anymore by human ways of thinking? For many, many years, decades, machine vision was a mess, to be honest. I mean, it was really, really frustrating. Machines could maybe recognize something, but there were so many mistakes. And whenever it got more complex, machines couldn't deal with it. But I think within the last 2-3 years, maybe 4, there has been a sort of quantum leap with that. And machines are actually better than humans now at recognizing certain objects. And now, you know, aspects of images are being decoded by machines, which seem funny, but which are also very scary. All sorts of emotions, you know, are being interpreted and quantified by machines. So what kind of entity is being developed right now? That's very, very fascinating, also scary. I mean, you see with financial algorithms, which were supposed to predict everything, that their worldview was pretty limited. No, they were not able to predict things that were not so difficult to predict, right? They wanted to see something. They were ideological, those algorithms, massively ideological. So in that sense, you know, of trying to find something which they don't know wouldn't have been that difficult. But I'm not excluding, right, that, you know, with